In Africa, between now and 2050, we expect the population to grow by another 900 million people. Those people are going to need jobs. 70 to 80% of those are going to be in this entrepreneurial sector.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. All over the world, entrepreneurs create businesses and provide jobs, and so too in Africa. But can the skills of an entrepreneur be trained? And if so, which skills will be most useful for Africa's young business people? An experiment in Uganda offers some exciting answers. Paul Gertler of UC Berkeley is one of the researchers. He joins me now. Paul, delighted to have you back on Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim. Pleasure to be here.
Paul, how important is entrepreneurship going to be in Africa in the next couple of decades?
Well, entrepreneurship is, since Schumpeter, has been thought of as the engine of economic growth. Entrepreneurs take risks, they develop new processes, new products, and efficiencies. So both in Western countries and in low and middle income countries, entrepreneurship really is critical. As such, it's critical for employment on two fronts. In Africa, 80% of the jobs are through self-employment, either entrepreneurs creating small and medium businesses or the 3 to 5 employees that they hire in order to run those businesses. In Africa, between now and 2050, we expect the population to grow by another 900 million people. Those people are going to need jobs. 70 to 80% of those are going to be in this entrepreneurial sector. So entrepreneurship is critical to African development.
And what you're saying gives us the clue that the entrepreneurs we're going to be talking about today aren't really like the ones that live down the other end of your road in California, in Silicon Valley. Are they people who have skills and ambition, they want to get on, but there just aren't jobs available in a formal economy?
Yeah, not many of them are tech bros owning vineyards in Napa Valley. But Africa's economy is driven by small self-employed entrepreneurs. And there really aren't many avenues to become a chairman of Microsoft or an engineer working for Google. Here, the opportunities, if you want to make a living, are to grow a business and particularly start one. And so we see lots of people who are good entrepreneurs who enter self-employment in Africa and lots of people who aren't. So it's critical in Africa that somehow we impart skills and we leverage whatever ability they have in order to help them be as successful as possible.
And to do this, you created this SEED program, that's the name of the program in Uganda, to help develop this next generation of entrepreneurs. So who is the program for and who's behind it?
The program came out of conversations I had with policymakers and the ILO when I was chief economist for human development at the World Bank. And African governments talked a lot about embedding entrepreneurship schools in their curriculum. Really strong, far-seeing leadership saying we have to adjust our school curriculum to give students the skills they're going to need to prepare them for the labor market. The ILO had developed an entrepreneurship training curriculum, which was being implemented in about 30 countries. And in talking with their head of evaluation, we said, well, why don't we go in and embed some evaluation to see if these programs are working? So we started in Uganda, and it turns out Uganda had not really implemented an entrepreneurship training program in school. So we said, well, why don't we do it? We partnered with a local NGO called Educate, which does leadership and entrepreneurship training to really develop this curriculum and implement it with Innovations for Poverty Action. The target was high school students, because we wanted to embed a curriculum at a very young age There are a couple reasons for this. One is this is before they begin their productive lives. So they're not tracked into an industry or a job. Maybe some sort of training will steer them away from ditch digging into some sort of business creation and management. Second, it turns out that this adolescence, say from age 15 through your early 20s, is a period of massive brain development, especially along social-emotional skills, self-regulation, intra and interpersonality skills or development. So the plasticity of the brain in these subject areas or in these skill areas is a perfect time to do this training. Later in life, the brain isn't as receptive to this type of training. And early in life, the brain is developing other skills. So the early childhood development movement is all taking advantage of let's stimulate the brain during a period of language acquisition, which is the key for everything. So we chose a period of brain development through which we could teach certain types of skills. The other thing about this population, which is unusual, it's high school students in Uganda, motivated, prepared kids, I'll call them. And I think that's an area which is quite important. It's an area to start with, because if we can get those students moving into entrepreneurship, then we can start moving down and seeing whether this type of training could impact other kids. It's also easier to deliver this training within a school context. So finding kids who are out of work, who are out of school and working full-time, married with kids, is much harder. So we took what we thought was the low-hanging fruit at the time, turned out to be fortuitous, because this was exactly the population that could benefit a lot from the type of intervention we were offering them.
For this group specifically, what sort of skills are you trying to give them? And how do you know which skills are going to be most useful to them?
One of the hypotheses or one of the research questions is, not only can we create successful entrepreneurs, but what skills really matter? And so part of the study was to try and delineate which set of skills matter the most. So we reviewed the literature, we talked to experts, we talked to advocates. And one thing that popped out of the literature was traditional business skills like accounting and finance, human resource management, at least from training, didn't seem to have large impacts on existing entrepreneurs or on. So these so-called hard skills in light touch interventions weren't really doing much, at least in the rigorous experimental evaluation literature. What people were talking about at the time were really soft skills, intra and interpersonality skills. So my ability to self-regulate, control my emotions, to be conscientious, grit. Can I start a task and finish it? How committed am I? Things like that. Plus interpersonality skills. How do I communicate? How do I negotiate? How do I lead? How do I organize and motivate a group of people to achieve some well-defined goal? So these so-called soft skills are something we wanted to look at. In fact, it was a little bit amusing. One of the co-investigators, Dana Carney, is a psychologist, and she and I are in the business school here at Berkeley, Haas Business School. We regularly would have lunch, and she would tell me how what she teaches, which is negotiation and personality skills, is much more important than what I teach, which is data analytics and big data and things like that. So as part of this study, we decided we would have a horse race for bragging rights. What we did was we created two tracks of training. These are three-week full-time on-site mini MBAs, in part modeled after the MBA at Berkeley. So you have 17, 18 days of full-time training. You live there, you eat there, you have football matches in the afternoon, you see movies at night, you go swimming on the weekend. It's a bit like summer camp. And one arm of the study was what I'll call hard skills intensive. And so 75% of the curriculum focused on what people think of as traditional business skills, the quantitative stuff. And the other 25% were inter and intro personality skills. And then in the other training, we flipped it, where 75% were soft skills and 25% were hard skills. Both tracks had daily business plan development, where we helped students prepare their own business plan to start jobs. It was very intensive. The other thing about this training, which I think is quite important to its success, is the curriculum was not only rigorous, but we developed presentation materials, session by session, visuals, exercises modeled after how we teach in the US. And then two, we did 6 weeks of teacher training. So we did half on how do you be a good teacher? You don't turn to the blackboard and write, you engage. And then 3 weeks on this curriculum. And then we had regular monitoring that it was being delivered as required by the teachers, and retraining if teachers weren't implementing the curriculum as we designed. So the intervention itself was really high quality. And I think lots of times interventions fail, not because they're a good idea, but because they're poorly implemented. So we wanted a negative result to be because training kids in business skills didn't matter, as opposed to we did a crappy job in training them in business skills.
But, Paul, you had these kids for, 3 weeks? So if you were training people at the high school, then you'd have them for a year or 2 years. Do you know that they learned enough in 3 weeks and that learning stuck, it persisted?
Well, that was a big question. So what we did was we administered tests before the program and after the program, and we saw a massive increase in knowledge. They absorbed the knowledge of what we were trying to teach, both in soft skills and hard skills. And if you were in the soft skills arm of the study, you not only learned more hard skills and more soft skills, but you learned more soft skills than the hard skills group.
Yeah.
And the hard skill learned more hard skills than the soft skills. And so our curriculum was really well absorbed, at least at the knowledge level. The question is, did that translate into behavior on these skills? Well, 3.5, 4 years later, we went and found about 90% of the people in the original study readministered the tests and found that their learning was substantially higher. And we saw large effects on more general tests like the Big Five personality tests. We saw reduced anxiety. We played a negotiation game where the respondent negotiated against the interviewer, and it was incentivized with money. And what we saw is in the soft skills group, they did substantially better, because that's where we taught negotiation, than either the control group or the hard skills group. We did a persuasion exercise where they had a minute to persuade us to do something. We recorded those. We took to the local business schools and had local business professors and students grade these things. And again, we saw that the soft skills group way outperformed the control group or the treatment group. So we measured learning immediately after the training, and then learning and translating that into actual skills 3.5 to 4 years later. And it looked like the training stuck. And the question you raise is really, I think, critical, not only to our study, to validating that, but again, general practice. Did the training do what you wanted it to do before you start looking at longer term and more distal outcomes?
And so to the real world test of this, Paul, did more of the young entrepreneurs that you gave training to, did they set up businesses? Were those businesses more successful?
Remarkably, this had a massive effect on business creation.
Great.
So yeah. 2,400 students were in both treatment arms together. They created 500 more businesses than they would have without the training.
Whoa.
They employed more too. They hired 1,000 more with the training than they would have otherwise. They attracted 70% more investment dollars or shillings in these businesses. So the training itself was quite successful. And then a third, these trainees, their income went up by about 30% more, primarily from income or the profits off these businesses. Now, the question you raise is a really interesting one, which is, well, did their earnings go up because they just started more businesses or they were actually better managers. Mm-hmm. So that question is still out because we can't compare businesses that were created in the treatment arm to businesses that were created in the control arm, because who started those businesses are different types of people. That's a form of selection bias. Mm-hmm. And the experiment wasn't set up in order to solve that problem and deal with that selection bias. But we're in the field right now doing an 8-year follow-up. And what we're going to look at is, did the businesses in the treatment arm grow faster than the businesses that were in the control arm? Or in this case, were they more resilient to the COVID shock? Because this is happening during COVID. Mm-hmm. And by looking at the change, comparing the treatment group to the control group, we can control for that selection bias. So I'll just have to come back and have you re-interview me to answer that last question.
We can edit it in at a later stage. But one thing you might be able to help me with is, what's the secret of success here? Is it the hard skills or is it the soft skills?
It turns out that after 3.5-4 years, the soft skills group caught up to the hard skills in knowledge of hard skills. And the hard skills group pretty much caught up generically to the soft skills as well. There were some differences in specific skills we taught, like negotiation and persuasion. So general skills seemed to catch up. Specific skills, the soft skills did better. There's some evidence that really the soft skills are really important, and this wouldn't have happened without the soft skills. But we didn't find significant differences between the two arms of the study in business creation, in employment creation, in investment. Where we did find effects on number of people who were induced to go into the wage sector. And the wage sector seemed to value those hard skills more.
Oh, yeah.
But I would say that soft skills are a necessary element for hard skills to matter. And really, we taught soft skills in both groups. Maybe we didn't get enough separation. We're going to learn more in subsequent analysis when we get this 8-year follow-up, because we'll be able to do some mediation analysis that we couldn't do with the 3.5-year follow-up.
Hey, you're following up at 8 years now, and you're still finding effects. And we deal with a lot of these interventions on Vox Dev Talks, where there is some rapid learning, and it shows good effects in the short run, but that fades away fairly quickly. Why do you think yours was more successful? Why did it stay with these entrepreneurs?
I think a number of things. I think the training was well designed and well implemented. I think we caught the kids or the adolescents at a period of rapid brain development where these types of skills are imprinted on the brain during that development. I think that beneficiaries found these skills or the training to be useful very early on in their economic welfare. Mm-hmm. And there was no reason to abandon that. And so we started them on the right path. And that path is a fundamental part of welfare or of the economic lives of these beneficiaries and their families. So that's what I think. Do I know? I don't know. The other piece of this that you alluded to is, and this is something I'm spending a lot more time on, which is looking at long-term follow-up of interventions. So a lot of interventions fade away. We look at 1-year success, declare victory, and then go tell places like the World Bank to put billions of dollars into that. And then we find it faded away. Now, you know, we should use that 1-year evidence to make decisions today. But the sustainability of the financing is really driven by these types of long-term studies. I would say the deworming study in Kenya now is going on a 25-year follow-up. Our work in Jamaica for the early childhood stimulation program, we just finished a 30-year follow-up. And we're finding in those instances that those interventions were really long-term sustainable. And I think in academia and the funders, we have short attention spans and we need longer attention spans in order to really follow up these studies to make sure they work long term.
Yes, comparing to those studies that you mentioned, you're a comparative newcomer. You've only been into this for about a decade now, Paul. Are you going to carry on following this up? Can you still carry on learning things about this?
Oh, yeah. I think what we're going to learn in this 8-year follow-up is not only did this training affect business creation, entrepreneurship, and earnings, but we're starting to learn that it affected women differently than men.
Oh.
That at least in a similar training, what we're finding is these skills empowered women to go on to college, to major more in STEM,
mm-hmm.
to find better partners with less intimate partner violence, compatible decision-making, improvement in the norms or the views of women in society. And so these types of trainings have social spillovers that we'd like to look over, which are not directly intended, but positive unintended consequences. And then at the 12-year follow-up, something we're already considering, we'd like to look at what happens to the children of these people.
Yes.
Is there intergenerational transmission of skills, especially along the personality and soft skills level, desire, values, things like that. So we can learn a tremendous amount by following up the beneficiaries of studies long-term.
That's inspiring work, Paul, and I wish you all the best with the follow-ups, and who knows, we'll probably be talking about this again, won't we? But thank you for coming in today and talking about it.
Thanks, Tim. Always a pleasure.
The paper is called Making Entrepreneurs: Returns to Training Youth in Hard versus Soft Business Skills. And the authors are Laura Chioda, David Contreras-Loya, Paul Gertler, and Dana Carney. This has been a VoxDev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. At this point, I always think I want to list all the other podcasts that are relevant to what we've just talked about. The list would be too long. So please go along to your podcast platform, type in VoxDev. You'll find our podcast, subscribe, and you can see them all for yourself. And our past episodes are, of course, all at voxdev.org, where you will also find articles about the papers we feature.